Good evening and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz and I'll be your host this evening. In this show, we'll be discussing conditions that affect gastrointestinal and colorectal health. The gastrointestinal system has been referred to as the second brain. It is connected to our immune system, our nervous system, our endocrine system, and really our whole body and overall health. Joining me in the studio this evening are Dr. Andrew Werner, colorectal surgeon with Colon and Rectal Associates in Shreveport, Dr. John Bienvenu, gastroenterologist with Willis-Knight and Bossier Gastroenterology, and also at LSU Health Sciences Center here in Shreveport, and nutritionist Julie Hartley. We invite you, our listening audience, to join in the discussion with your questions or comments by calling 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. So the gastrointestinal tract is really an integral part of our daily functioning, and we often take it for granted until we have problems. Problems in the gastrointestinal tract actually represents one of the most common problems affecting people and is one of the main reasons people go to the doctor. This evening, we're going to talk about problems involving the gastrointestinal tract, including problems that can be addressed surgically or with medication or even with diet. When we think of gastrointestinal disorders, we generally break them down into two different types. One are functional disorders, which are those where the gastrointestinal tract looks normal but perhaps doesn't function properly. And then we have structural problems where there's actually physical abnormalities that can be seen and addressed. This evening, Dr. John Bienvenu is our gastroenterologist. And Dr. Bienvenu, welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you for having us on, Sandy.
So can you tell our listeners what a gastroenterologist does?
Sure. So gastroenterologists deal with the digestive tract, which really affects the body from the mouth to the anus. And it also includes the liver and the gallbladder. And we deal with problems, both functional and structural, as well as infectious, that affect anywhere in that organ system.
Very good. And Julie, as a nutritionist, can you tell me a little bit and our listeners about how diet has an impact on the gastrointestinal health?
Well, sure. It, you know, just like you said in the introduction, it's our second brain. It has the immune system, and of course, all the foods that we eat have nutrients and that can affect the GI tract. So some people can eat, you know, there's not one diet that's going to affect everybody the exact same way. So it's really an individual approach when it comes to GI issues.
Okay. And Dr. Werner, as a colorectal surgeon, what sort of patients come to see you in your practice as a colorectal specialist?
I see a wide variety of patients, from patients who absolutely require surgery with cancer to patients with constipation, anything that affects the colon, the rectum, the anus, anything on the lower end of the gastrointestinal tract.
Okay, so it would be fair to say that that each of you here see folks with problems that are could be potentially functional or structural or infectious.
Sure.
Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Okay. So when we talk about functional disorders, Dr. Bin, you mentioned infections, but I understand that there can be problems related to motility, let's say. That is how well the bowels are moving. Let's see, hypersensitivity, how they feel, whether someone's having pain or discomfort. Immunity could be altered in the GI tract, as well as the infectious process you mentioned could occur. And then I guess also in the control of their bowels. Is that correct?
Absolutely. All those come into play.
Now, you also mentioned that from the mouth to the anus is considered the part of the GI tract. So I guess to start off with, if we go a little bit below the mouth, the esophagus. So what would be the most common thing somebody with an esophageal problem would come to see you for?
Oh, by far the most common complaint we have in our practice with upper GI problems would be from problems related to reflux and heartburn, where we have a reflux of gastric contents into the esophagus. And most of the time, those contents are very acidic because the stomach is an acidic location. It has an acidic milieu within it. And we're not supposed, we're not designed to have reflux of gastric contents into the esophagus. And when that occurs, it results in symptoms for many of us. Not all of us, but many of us. And that manifests itself as pain, discomfort, burning. People can sometimes think they're having a heart attack. More important to rule out the heart attack before you say it's reflux instead. But certainly reflux is one of the most common problems we encounter.
So I'll share my own experience with listeners. I personally was having some trouble with a chronic cough. And it had occurred after an upper respiratory illness, and I thought, wow, this is just a kind of reactive type of bronchitis. So I was treated with steroids, and it didn't get better and didn't get better. And then I was out to dinner one day. It went on for weeks and months, and I went out to dinner one day with a friend. And while we were eating dinner, I started coughing. And he said, you know, I think you have reflux. And sure enough, when I was evaluated, I had some telltale signs of reflux, but I had no burning or belching.
Sure.
Or it was just a cough.
Sure.
Is that typical?
It can be typical, especially it's something that we always consider in patients that have a chronic cough. One of about two or three diagnoses we try to exclude before doing some other investigative work.
So what is that investigative work that you would do if someone came to you with these sort of complaints, let's say burning, belching, discomfort?
Well, it depends on the individual, first of all, and oftentimes the chronicity of their complaints. So if a patient doesn't have any major risk factors, meaning they haven't had these symptoms for a long time, they're not having any trouble swallowing, and they have fairly typical reflux events and symptoms, then oftentimes we will empirically treat them, meaning we will give them some medication that usually results in a decrease of the acid production within the stomach to see if that doesn't improve some of their symptoms. Going along with medication use, however, is kind of emphasis on lifestyle changes and choices that they make that can also help reduce the frequency and severity of their symptoms. Some things they can do on their own without having to resort to medications.
Like what?
Number one, many patients can often identify foods that set them off, that are triggers for their reflux. And we can say, well, either stay away from those foods, or if you know you're going to eat them, then maybe we should take some antacids before engaging in meals of that nature. Additionally, one of the biggest problems we have in the United States is an obesity problem. And as we gain weight, we tend to increase reflux events into the lower esophagus. Our lower esophageal sphincter, which is not really a flap, but really a kind of a muscular ring of tissue that stays tight in the resting state, becomes weak and loose as we gain weight, okay? And so even losing modest amounts of weight, 10 to 15 pounds, can result in marked symptomatic improvement for some people. We see a lot of people that come in, and when we sit down and talk to them, they notice that they put on 10 to 15, 20 pounds over the last 6 months to 1 year, and their reflux symptoms have really worsened over that time period. So along with medication, dietary changes, weight loss is a big part of that as well.
I see. And now people can take many of these antacid type medications over the counter and treat themselves.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Where I know not too long ago it was a prescription. And we have a listener who sent in a question, and we encourage listeners to call in at 1-800-552-8502. You can either call in and speak on the air, or you can send in your question to one of the folks manning our phones. But so this listener, who has been on Prilosec for presumably reflux, is concerned because they thought they heard that perhaps Prilosec can cause cancer. And they want to know, should they stay on it, or is there another medication, or what are the risks associated with perhaps treating yourself with Prilosec?
Sure. So I think before starting any medication long term or discontinuing any medication that you've taken long term, you want to speak with your either primary care physician or the specialist who's prescribing you those medications. But there have been a lot of studies done recently that have come out in the literature and been popular in the press lately, talking about this class of medication called PPIs, which are also known as proton pump inhibitors. And these medications prevent the stomach from producing stomach acid. And for a long time, they've been thought of as being probably one of the safest classes of medications that we use in medicine as a whole. But there have been some retrospective studies that have suggested possible links with kidney problems, pneumonias, vitamin and mineral deficiencies, as well as a possible link to cognitive problems later in life. And while none of these studies establish causation or prove that these medications directly result in these problems, it's always wise to use any medication at the lowest effective dose, and if it's not needed, then discontinue its use. And for a lot of people, they may be able to get off the PPIs long term and only use them when they have flares of their symptoms. But again, it's something you should talk to your physician about.
So you mentioned dietary and lifestyle changes and losing some weight. Julie, what sort of dietary changes would you suggest in somebody who's having trouble with reflux or perhaps has put on some weight and is trying to modify their diet so that they can address both of these issues?
Well, certainly lifestyle changes are going to make a significant difference, and a lot of times we can see them dramatically improve their symptoms, if not, completely resolve their symptoms just through what their, lifestyle is doing. Because, I'm sure both of the doctors have seen such a dramatic increase in heartburn issues and digestive-related issues just in the last decade. The way that we eat so fast in the car, we're fast foods, we eat lots of processed foods, a lot of foods that are devoid of nutrition, and then their natural enzymes. So what happens is that, now we don't have a lot of good digestive acid to break down our foods. It goes to the, digestive tract undigested and can cause heartburn. And then on top of that, there's a lot of marketing to the public about over-the-counter, treating your problem over-the-counter. Because it's so common, doesn't mean it's normal. So whenever we see a commercial, whether it's a guy, there's plenty of commercials out there. One of my favorites is, he's at a barbecue and he's eating all kinds of, things that would cause a lot of heartburn. But he just, lucky for him, he's got a pill that he pops and then, he's continue on with the barbecue with no problem. And so what that's teaching us is to not be able to manage the signals that are coming from our body. When we start to have issues with acid reflux, it's a significant issue. We want to, definitely go see a healthcare professional because it could be a key to other problems. So whenever we're really looking, so just simple changes like even chewing their food better. First of all, I like to see exactly what they're eating, before I would ever suggest an over-the-counter medication. Maybe we would do that temporarily just to manage the problem and get it under control. But let's really see what they're eating. If I can change their food to more whole foods, plant-based foods, a lot of times their issues, completely resolve, and if not, they would need even less medication. Also, exercise is going to play a big part of that. How they eat. So we don't chew very well. We, a lot of us, most men, only chew like one or two times a bite. We really need to be up there like 25 times, a bite. But of course, nobody has that kind of time. We're eating on the run, in the car. That's causing a lot of stress on the body too, which is not good for digestion either. So there's several different ways that we can modify lifestyle factors before we just start on a medication that could then cause a lot of the other side effects that we're hearing about now.
I'd like to jump in on that, on the lifestyle modification. I see a lot of people with constipation, mm-hmm. and they come in and they say, I'm getting in a lot of fiber, I juice every day. But I say, time out. Let's go back to that juicing. There was a huge juicing fad recently a couple of years ago, and the juicing takes away the chewing.
Yeah, the fiber.
And chewing is an important component of the second brain. If you talk about the intestinal tract being from mouth to anus, the mouth chewing the food, you get a lot of enzymes going from that. That's the beginning of the whole process, and juicing gets rid of that. So I think it's important to chew the food, okay? And I agree completely. Slow down, chew your food. Plants are the main thing that we're supposed to eat. We're designed for eating plants mainly.
Yeah.
So let's say that you did that. Let's say you were eating a better diet. You didn't eat too late at night. You're limiting your caffeine, let's say, and your alcohol, and you still have this persistent gnawing pain in your stomach. You know, sometimes it's relieved by eating. You know, you've been using these medications. It's not really getting better. Dr. Benvenue, now you get a patient like this, and they give you that history, or you've tried those medications, and they're still having problems. What's the next step as far as diagnosing them?
If we're talking about symptoms that are related to reflux or upper abdominal pain, kind of located in the top part of the abdomen, or maybe in the substernal location, and may have some association with food, and we've tried PPIs and antacids without much success in symptom relief, then oftentimes we will recommend what's called an upper endoscopy, or an EGD. And that's a procedure where we look down in the esophagus, the stomach, and the first part of the small intestines with a lighted scope. And it's a sedated procedure. You're given sedation so you don't remember or recall anything from the procedure. And that allows us to look for structural problems like reflux esophagitis, where the mucosa of the esophagus is actually damaged from acid reflux events, or peptic ulcer disease, or any other problems that might result in those painful type symptoms. There is an infection that can chronically infect the stomach called Helicobacter pylori, and routine antacid medication is not going to result in clearance or cure of that infection. And so sometimes upper endoscopies or other tests are needed to diagnose those types of problems.
Now, what if somebody has an ulcer or you hear also people say, I have a hiatal hernia. Mm-hmm. What exactly does that mean?
So a hiatal hernia, a lot of people talk about their hiatal hernias, and they attribute all their digestive problems to hiatal hernias. And in actuality, the majority of the time, hiatal hernias are incidental findings when we do an upper endoscopy. And by and large, you know, depending on the size of the hernia, most of the time they're small or moderate sized. And those types of, in those sizes of hernias don't usually result in much, if any, symptom problems. However, when we talk about hiatal hernias, this is a weakness in the diaphragm of the body, where a small portion of the stomach has actually been pulled above the diaphragm, which generally separates the esophagus from the stomach. And so you have a little bit of stomach that resides above the diaphragm and can result in a bulge. If that gets large enough, then people can have increased problems with reflux, occasionally trouble swallowing, some nausea. But by and large, small and moderate-sized hiatal hernias don't result in much of in the way of symptom symptomatology for patients.
If it does mm-hmm. that require surgery?
To fix a hiatal hernia, you do need surgery.
And are there surgical procedures to address reflux?
There are. And in fact, there's a newer device on the market called the Lynx device, Lynx procedure. And this is a ring, almost like a bracelet of small magnets with connected by a series of wires. And this is surgically placed around the lower esophageal sphincter, so right above where the esophagus joins the stomach. And this allows for that sphincter that I mentioned earlier to be more tight, okay? So when we are resting, when we're not eating, that sphincter should remain closed, okay? And one of the problems is if that sphincter is not tight, then you have the constant reflux of gastric contents into the esophagus that results in symptoms. So this is a procedure. It's been placed in about 10,000 people now, and safety is very good, and so far it appears that the result in terms of reducing or eliminating reflux in appropriate patients is good as well.
I see. We have a caller calling in from Marshall, Texas, this is an anonymous caller. Yes, Marshall, welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you. I had C. diff about a year ago, and they treated it with two rounds of whatever, is it vancomycin? Or
Right, vancomycin.
Anyway, it took a long time to get rid of it. But what it's left me with is ISD with diarrhea. And we can't seem to get rid of it.
Sure. So,
C. diff, when the caller is referring to, is an infection that causes chronic diarrhea. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I wanted to have a fecal transplant, but I can only have a fecal transplant if I still have C. diff. Is that correct?
That's correct. I don't think anybody is going to perform a fecal transplant unless you have an active C. diff infection.
Yeah, but see, I didn't have ISB with diarrhea until I finished the rounds of antibiotics and the C. diff went away.
Sure. So one thing that we encounter a lot is something called post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome, okay? And in your case, it was triggered by C. diff, and you had an infection that sounds like it was cleared with antibiotics, but you're still left with these adverse symptoms. And IBS stands for irritable bowel syndrome. And patients can run the gamut. It's probably more common to have diarrheal-type symptoms that are problematic and uncomfortable and socially upsetting occasionally, to constipation or a mix of symptoms in between. And these symptoms of post-infectious IBS can often last upwards of 6 to 9 months in people. And there are a variety of medications and lifestyle changes, again, that can be employed to try to reduce the symptomatology associated with that.
Dr. Warner.
I would agree that C. diff has probably been cured with antibiotics. However, the antibiotics don't just kill C. diff; they kill a whole lot of your other bacteria in your colon, and the
right,
colon.
I am taking
probiotics.
Yes, I am.
Right, and it may take a while to reestablish all those good bacteria in your colon. I'm sitting here looking at Julie's drinking a sparkling probiotic drink in front of me. And I preach the benefits of probiotics on a daily basis, and it may take a while. There's not a whole lot of science behind probiotics. It's mostly talked about, but not really scientific in the textbooks yet. But there is a lot of research going into that in all over the place.
Yeah. Good luck with what I understand must be a very distressing problem. I hope it gets better real soon. Thanks for your call. So the probiotic drinks, is kombucha one of those?
Yes, kombucha is one. It's really the fermentation, and you know I can address the lady from Marshall's question as well. And just like Dr. Warner was saying, is that antibiotics of any kind, whether you know whatever you're taking them for, you really want to be conscious that it does kill off a lot of good bacteria. And I agree, we have a lot. This is kind of a black hole, you know, the probiotics. There's lots of different kinds out on the market, and some work for some people, and then some, you know, we've seen can even make situations worse, you know, just depending. So a good way to recommend getting probiotics in the diet is through fermentation, fermented foods. So kombucha would be a fermented drink. I'm drinking a fermented, it's called kefir, and it's a fermented coconut water. Another way to get is like fermented sauerkraut, you know, things that you would get. Now, let me explain. There's a big difference between the kind that you would get just on the shelf, you know, that's dry. We want live, you know, real probiotics, and you would find that in like a store in the refrigerated section, usually in the health food store. But you know, whenever you get a probiotic over the counter, you might be looking at maybe a billion, 5 billion. When you eat a fermented food, even like 2 forkfuls of a really good sauerkraut, a fermented sauerkraut, you're looking at trillions of different probiotics. So it's a vast difference. Plus, you're getting a lot of different strains, because when you buy them over the counter, you might just be getting one strain. And let me just kind of back up to, for those that don't know exactly what probiotics are, they're just good healthy bacteria. So they're like bugs in your system. So you're getting all different kinds. I try to explain it like a garden or your soil. So there's all different kinds of bugs in the soil or that, you know, make the soil healthier. And so we also have that, you know, in what we call our gut microbiome. You know, it's just different, you know, kinds of bacteria that we're still trying to research all different ones that you know, do different things. And so having a good variety of them instead of just one, if you take one over the counter, you're just getting that, you know, one, like lactobacillus is one that a lot of people are very familiar with. But if you're just taking the same one over the counter over and over and over again, you could be getting, you know, an imbalance in that particular bacteria. So the best way is to really get a diverse diet and not only get probiotics, but have a high fiber diet so that you're getting enough prebiotics. So if probiotics are bugs, prebiotics is like food for the bugs. So it helps keep the healthy bugs healthy and fed. And so high fiber foods, the ones we were just talking about, the whole plant-based foods are really rich in those too.
So if you use the kombucha as, let's say, a mixer with vodka or some other alcohol, does that kill off the good biotics?
You know, that's the first time I've ever had that question, and I don't know the exact answer, but...
I was thinking this lime, mint, coconut would go good with rum.
I have to admit that
we could put a little umbrella in there, and I would not think so, you know, because it's fermented.
Okay, good, because I like kombucha with a little bit
well,
of
we'll
vodka
go with that,
personally.
We're going with
So, Dr. Werner, you know, chronic diarrhea, rums like this lady from Marshall... been suffering with. So someone comes to you with, let's say, a change in their bowel habits.
Going back to her problem, and she's discussed the stool transplant.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing that's kind of come in to the literature lately. Stool transplants are it's not something anyone wants to talk about or admit that they've had. Where did they get it? You know, actually, they come from a donor who's been screened. They're basically... frozen stool from someone. I think they come out of Houston.
There's several stool banks now commercially available.
Donors who are, you know, blood tested weekly and, you know, assessed for all kind of health reasons. But an alternative to having a stool transplant is doing the prebiotics and the probiotics to repopulate your colon. And like Julie said, you don't want just lactobacillus. You want acidophilus, bifidobacter. There are thousands of bacteria in your second brain, the colon, the intestinal tract. And when you look at a stool, if you go by weight, the major component of a stool is bacteria. And so it's very important to your diarrhea, your constipation, your bowel movements in general, to have the right mixture of good bacteria to outbalance those C. diffs and those bad bacteria that can cause problems. And I agree with her completely that prebiotics and probiotics are a wave coming in the future that everyone's going to be talking about.
So at what point should somebody be concerned about a change in their bowel habits that would prompt them to come to see you or to have an evaluation? I would assume that an occasional constipation, occasional diarrhea is not unusual, but what sort of changes should somebody...
I think we're all supposed to have occasional bouts of constipation and occasional bouts of diarrhea. Our bodies are designed. We ate unprocessed food. We ate contaminated food for thousands and thousands of years. And diarrhea was expected. And many people postulate that that's why the appendix is there. It's our little bacterial reservoir to repopulate the intestines, the colon, with the good bacteria coming out of the appendix. So there are studies that show people who've had an appendectomy, if they get colon cancer, they have a worse prognosis. So I think the appendix is our friend. We should keep it if we can. Back to your question about
the question is that
when should
what
people
point
come?
Should someone say, hey, you know what? I think I should be checked out. Because something's not right with my stools. They're not normal. What sort of changes in someone's stool should they be concerned about?
How long should we accept severe diarrhea? A week or two. I wouldn't go any longer than that.
And constipation?
Same thing. It depends on what you consider constipation. Some people have a bowel movement every day, but they have to strain to get it out, and they call that constipation. I really call that an evacuation problem. Some people go to the bathroom once a month. That's what I call severe constipation.
What about a change in stool caliber?
The size of the bowel movement is another interesting thing that can be a red flag for colon cancer, rectal cancer, or inflammatory bowel disease, or anorectal dysfunction, there's a wide array of problems that that could be indicative of. The change in a bowel caliber, again, if it persists for more than a few weeks, that should probably be checked out.
It seems like constipation is seemingly a more of a problem of the elderly or the aged, or at least they seem to talk about it more than younger people do.
Absolutely, and that's the third phase of life when we talk about
right.
our bowel movements. So you have to have a good bowel movement.
What are the, my grandmother used to say that, it was
a
good day.
Yeah.
That's all I needed for a great day. So what are the major causes of constipation?
Oh.
Dr. Ben,
dietary problems obviously play a big role in constipation, and one of our first things we turn to in treating someone who's complaining of constipation is look at their dietary habits and making sure that they are intaking enough dietary fiber. One thing that can develop in the colon in many of us as we get older in age is something called diverticulosis or diverticular disease. And in the West, that's thought to develop because we probably lack enough dietary fiber in the majority of us. If you go to India or other Asian countries where they eat lots of fiber, they don't have diverticulosis. Or we see it in at least a third of patients as we get older. So diet plays a big part of this. But there are other things we need to be aware of when we evaluate constipation as well. There are some metabolic diseases that can result in problems stooling and things like hypothyroidism that can... I've diagnosed several patients with hypothyroidism after they presented with complaints of constipation, and that's diagnosed by a simple blood test. And there are some other metabolic derangements that can cause problems as well. But looking at a patient's dietary history is probably one of the first things we do when a patient comes to us complaining of constipation. Another big deal is a lot of us as we get age are on multiple medications. Okay, a lot of the blood pressure medications we use have side effects. Calcium channel blockers, beta blockers, those sorts of things can often result in decreased motility of the GI tract. So that's something we investigate as well.
Narcotics.
Narcotics. Absolutely, common. That's a huge one that I failed to mention. But while we can become tolerant to increasingly high doses of opiates for pain relief purposes, we never become tolerant to the constipatory effects of them. And in patients that are on chronic narcotics that we can't get them off of, there are some newer medications on the market now that kind of help overcome those constipatory effects of the narcotics.
Very good. Well, we're getting a little backed up with our callers, so no pun intended. We're going to welcome Celeste from, I think it's Luckland. Celeste, welcome to Health Matters.
How are you?
Very good. How are you this evening?
I'm okay. I just have a question about the liquid probiotics, the kefir and that sort of thing, the... is there a recommended amount that you should have? And I was wondering, is there any association with starting on those? And I used to never belch, but since I have been doing kefir and kombucha, I have sometimes a spontaneous belch that I don't even know that's coming.
Yes, I can help you address that question. So first of all, you're just wondering if there's a specific... serving size or how much of those. Well, when it comes to just the fermented foods like we were talking about earlier, even just as small as just a couple of spoonfuls are beneficial. But when it comes to kefir and some of the other drinks, because they're getting to be more popular, you used to only be able to find them in health food stores. Now you can go to grocery stores and find them. They're getting to be a lot more popular, a lot more flavors, and so therefore you're going to start to also find more sugar additive, and they're going to be, they're not as pure as the ones we have. People that are purists that still make kombucha in their house, but there's really not a specific size you should start off with. But because it's a fermented food, and especially if you have GI issues, usually recommend just starting out with about 4 ounces just to see how it's going to affect you. Again, not everybody does well with probiotics, and So especially if you have a lot of inflammation in the gut, we really want to figure out where it's coming from first. So really start off small, see how it affects you, and then you can start to add on to like 12 to 16 ounces, especially the ones that do not have added sugar in them as well. I also wanted to point out that a lot of them are dairy. So if you have a dairy sensitivity or a dairy allergy, that some of those can be, you know, harmful to the, you know, to you and cause even more problems. So I like the coconut water kefirs are not a dairy form and still can provide a lot of the benefits too. So you just kind of look around and check some of those out.
I think it's important to go back to the old food pyramid too and work on your fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
And get the basic ingredients in.
We all want the next big thing or the easiest. We want to drink, you know, but mostly just like going back to just when you talked about constipation. It's so much about their lifestyle. We can spend a lot of time just going back, and they think it's something really big or, you know, really problematic, when a lot of times we look and I'm like, you have one glass of water a day and that's all you have. Just increasing their water intake can dramatically help just with their constipation issues. But but people think that it's a simple thing, and so they don't think that it's important to do. So I think I'll usually always say, if it's simple to, you know, if it's simple to do, it's also simple to forget. And so we don't really measure that. So people are like, oh, I drink a lot of water, but when I have them really keep track of what they're doing, you know, they're like, wow, I'm drinking more coffee. Coffee does not count as water, even though you put water in there. It still is not the same thing as, you know, pure 8 ounce glasses of water a day.
I've got a lot of people sent to me for chronic constipation. They need their colon taken out. Big surgery. Well, let's talk about your diet. And there's just no fruits and vegetables. McDonald's twice a day is not adequate.
Right. And if they think they eat brown bread, they're getting plenty of fiber, because you mentioned fiber, you know, just a little while ago. Most Americans are getting less than about 10 grams of fiber, and we want them up there. 35 is really the, you know, the least amount. I like them closer to 50. And if they're eating a whole foods, plant-based diet, lots of plants, we eat lots of meat, lots of fast food, and even the foods that we think are you know, healthy, like maybe an applesauce, for instance. You know, instead of an apple, we think of applesauce as being like a fruit. And by the time it goes through the processing plant, it's lost all of its fiber, all of its nutrients. They've added sugar and they've added salt. So we really don't even have a good understanding of what real food actually is.
Right. Eating that apple, again, starting with the chewing.
Yes, yes.
Thank you for your call, Celeste. So staying on this topic of food, there are all these diets. You mentioned sugar, you mentioned fiber. Can you comment a little, Julie, on the various diets, the paleo diet, the low-carb diet, even the gluten-free diet? What do you think of these?
Well, I don't like to put labels on things, you know. So basically, I don't like to say you need to be a vegetarian or you need to eat paleo. Now, having said that, there are some aspects of different diets that I think work well, especially, you know, I see a lot of autoimmune disorders. And one of the things they'll come in thinking they're just going to talk about their diet, and I'll start asking them about their bowel habits. And they think, well, what in the world would constipation have to do with rheumatoid arthritis? And the answer is everything. It has everything to do with that. It's one of the hallmarks of autoimmune disease. And so we know with that, some people, we have to get their digestion working right. We have to clear up some of the inflammation in their gut. In order to do that, sometimes we might have to take away grains, for instance, which would be more like a modified paleo diet. So I don't really say you're going to be on paleo, you're going to be vegetarian. As long as we can get whole foods, I try to explain what real foods are, lots of fiber, I can get plants in there. So for some people, gluten is an issue. Again, we see gluten as an allergy for celiac disease. So that's the very end of the spectrum, which means you have an absolute allergy to gluten. It's really toxic for your body to handle. But there, what we've seen, especially over the last 10 years, and we know that gluten is a fad. So there's a lot of people like, oh, gluten-free. There's a lot of gluten-free junk food out there. I'll just still processed foods so that we try to stay away from. But I have seen a lot of GI issues and inflammation clear up once we start to take gluten out of people's diet. So it really is an individual basis. I usually say, you know, you've seen one autoimmune case with GI issues, you've seen one, because everybody is different. Some people react to gluten and dairy pretty heavily. That's pretty much the first two ingredients that we try to play with, take them out, see how they do, and then add them back and see if we can get a reaction. If so, we know we need to take them out.
Elimination diet. Yeah.
Yeah, the elimination diet is just excellent for everybody to do. And then if we put them back in and fix their inflammation and start to have healing in the gut, then some things that they had been allergic to before, maybe they can start to have again. So, but gluten and dairy are usually two big offenders.
So invariably, if somebody's dealing with chronic constipation and they're straining, or chronic diarrhea, oftentimes they'll end up with the manifestations of that affecting their anus. And there's a host of problems that can occur there, I know. So Dr. Werner, what sort of problems around the anus do you encounter?
Everything. There's, for constipated people, especially those who strain to have a bowel movement, they get hemorrhoids. Hemorrhoids are just bulging of hemorrhoidal veins that are normal in everyone. When they get big, they swell up. They can cause pain. They can cause bleeding. They can cause itching. They can cause a little leakage. So there's a lot of symptoms that hemorrhoids can cause. If we go back to the cause of the hemorrhoids, then we're talking about straining, and maybe we're talking about an evacuation problem. Maybe they've had a couple of 10-pound children. All their muscles down there are torn, and maybe they need a little help tightening things up to help them have a bowel movement better. Maybe it's just diet, and like I said, eating at McDonald's twice a day is not the answer. So there are various causes for hemorrhoids. My number one thing that I see these days is cell phones in the bathroom. People just sitting there playing on their cell phone, reading, playing games, sitting there for an hour.
Does that affect your anus?
That does. Gravity wins. The blood vessels swell. The longer you're sitting there, the hemorrhoids get bigger. They bleed. They thrombose. They get all kinds of problems.
So now, what about the squatty potty? Mm-hmm. I think, you can't tell if people are sitting on the toilet longer because they're having difficulty evacuating, or if it's they're just getting caught up in their phones. But the squatty potty, I understand, they proposed that they're going to get you in and out so you don't have time to play on your cell phone. What do you think about
that? Is it because you're using something that's making you focus on how you're having a bowel movement to get you out quicker? Or is it actually the position with your knees up above the level of your anus?
What do you think?
I don't know the answer to that. I personally think it's probably getting out quicker, but a lot of people say the squatty potty works. Mm-hmm. So if it works for you, keep doing it.
Got it. Now, what about these hemorrhoids? What do you do for those? How do you know if you need to go see the doctor? Are they going to get better on their own? Do you need to have medicine for that? Surgery? How do you address those?
Again, let's go back to that. If it's been there for more than a couple of weeks, probably let somebody check it out. If it's excruciatingly painful, probably go to the doctor. If it's bleeding more than a little bit, what's a little bit? A little bit on the tissue. Well, bleeding is never actually normal, so mention that to your doctor, primary care, your gastroenterologist, your colorectal surgeon, whoever, and that they can take a look. There may be something more sinister going on upstream.
So if someone's having, let's say, rectal bleeding, blood in their stools from time to time, maybe it's a little bit more frequent lately, when should they be concerned that it's something perhaps more serious than hemorrhoids? How do they know?
You don't know without looking. Nope. And that's the next step. And no blood is normal. So if you've got blood that's going on for more than a couple of weeks, you need to get it checked out. If you're, more than 20 years old, probably, you may want to even have a colonoscopy. There's a new onset. There's been the literature lately about the younger onset of colon cancer now. 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds having more colon cancer.
So can you screen for that?
Well, if you're bleeding, that's not really screening. That's diagnostic, and that's looking for the source of the bleeding. Screening Everyone at age 50 needs screening. Some people say African Americans at 45 need screening. If there's a family history of colon polyps or colon cancer, age 40 for screening.
So does screening entail a scope, or is it, what about these cards that you can send in with a stool sample?
There's hemocult cards that are checked for any occult non-visible blood in your stool. That uses a reagent called guaiac to see if there's any blood in that stool. There's also DNA testing in your of your bowel movements to see if there's any DNA that are suspicious for polyps or cancer. So those are all new. That's not standard of care. I wouldn't say it's becoming the latest thing, I would say, and it's a little more expensive. Maybe John, you might have any.
I think the most important thing to remember is that you know, colon cancer is very common and a very serious and oftentimes very preventable disease. And the goal with any screening test is to find problems before they develop into something much more serious. So some of the tests, which test for blood or DNA within cancer tumors, you know, a problem is already there when those tests return positive. So for procedures like colonoscopies, we are looking for polyps more so than colon cancer because we want to take polyps off before they have the potential to turn into something bad like a cancer.
Can you explain what a polyp is?
Sure. So a polyp is a little growth within the colon, and it's an abnormal growth. And there are different kinds of polyps, some of which are much more serious than others. But the take-home message is that pretty much every colon cancer or rectal cancer starts with a colon polyp. And so the goals with our screening colonoscopies are to find these abnormal growths and remove them before they can turn into a cancer. Because it's much easier to treat that than it is to treat a polyp and remove a polyp than it is to treat a colon cancer. Because if I find a colon cancer, you're going to go be seeing Dr. Werner and an oncologist and on down the road, a lot of other people. Things get much more involved very quickly when that happens.
So Dr. Werner mentioned that there's recommended parameters in terms of when people are supposed to be screened with a colonoscopy. He mentioned age 50,
sure,
unless you have a family history of colon polyps, and then I understand it's 10 years before that.
Sure.
The age that the person first had their polyps. And then what's the frequency of the colonoscopies that people should be getting?
So it largely depends on what they find on that first colonoscopy, okay? So if you have adenomatous polyps, which are some of the most common polyps that we find that have the potential to become cancerous over time, then depending on the number and the size that are found on your colonoscopy will determine how frequently you need to come back, how long it is till we see you for your next visit. And that can be oftentimes anywhere from 3 to 5 years. If you have a nice clean prep for your procedure, so we get very good views and can look behind every fold within the colon and feel like we have seen all the real estate, then sometimes we give patients as long as 10 years. And if they have risk factors, primary family members with a history of colon cancer or some other genetic predispositions to developing colon cancer, then that's often decreases the intervals for their repeat colonoscopies.
But I don't know of any dietary changes to prevent colon cancer. Julie, are you aware of
other
anything?
Than just high fiber? To make sure that we're not getting constipated and, you know, staying on top of that. Because, again, just like heartburn and constipation, we think it's so common because everybody has it that it's not a big deal anymore. And so people aren't going to get the proper attention, especially for young people like you mentioned. They're, you know, one of the worst of eating processed food. Their diet's really terrible. They're not exercising like they should. They're certainly not drinking water. And then all of their friends are constipated. And so they just think this is the norm, and so they, you know, don't seek help often enough or early enough like they should
until it's really bleeding, and then it's too late.
We have a caller, Carol from Bossier. Carol, welcome to Health Matters.
My question is from you guys, which you're already addressing, but if I'd like to hear your thoughts on the emerging practice of functional medicine, and whether we are not able to get about this practice,
Kara, we'll have a little trouble hearing you. If you can get a little closer to your phone, and if you have a radio on in the background, if you could turn that down, please.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry about that. Is that better?
Oh, much better.
Okay. I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm just curious, like, summarizing your thoughts. I would like to hear your thoughts on the emerging practice of functional medicine and the viability of this new specialty. And do we have any functional medicine practices, or what functional medicine practices do we have in Shreveport-Bossier?
Can you give us an example as to what you mean by functional medicine?
I can actually speak to that. I'm certified in functional medicine.
Oh, good.
Well, there's your answer right there. We have one right here in the studio.
It is new and emerging, and you know, many healthcare providers don't really necessarily know exactly what it is. And basically, what it is that we treat the root cause. We're always, instead of just looking at just GI, just in the gut, we know that you know, now sometimes if we have a migraine, we'll go see someone for a migraine headache and get migraine medicine. If we have GI issues, we're seeing a GI doctor. If we have tendonitis, we might see an orthopedic. But in functional medicine, it's one healthcare practitioner, or we work in conjunction with others that really take what we call a holistic approach. So not holistic in that we don't use medicine, and holistic is in the part where it's the whole body. So we know that depression can absolutely be related to gut health, and gut health can, you know, have issues with tendonitis or, you know, other joint issues. And so all of these things are related, but we're still in Shreveport, Louisiana, so it just hasn't, you know, unfolded as much. But there are some really thriving practices in the bigger cities like Dallas and in Houston and that sort of thing. So really anybody can have a functional medicine approach. It's just that there are specialized certifications that they're, you know, that a lot of doctors of all different specialties are going to get to just be able to see a patient in a much different way.
So how is this different than primary care?
So it's just, again, it's a little bit of the same, but they're also using, lifestyle medicine plays a huge part in, is one of the basis of functional medicines. There's also genes, plays. We look at, gene expression and those kinds of things to see, but it's really looking at the patient from birth to where they are now. So I ask questions a lot, the intake form would be, not just where are you now and what are your symptoms, what was your mother's health like? Were you a C-section baby? Were you formula fed? Did you have exposure to a lot of pesticides? Did you live on a farm or with a lot of chemicals? Just all different things that would play into a part. So it is still a little like primary care. It's just a little more in depth.
In addition to what you're saying, I understand that genetics are often involved.
Yeah, another big area of research is genetics, that that we're not just bound to genetics. It's called nutrigenomics or epigenetics, and that our lifestyle has the ability to actually turn on and off gene expression, which is really exciting.
I don't think that genetics, though, is unique to alternative medicines.
No, no.
And another thing that's popular in functional medicine is detoxification, and we're getting back to that, what we talked about earlier, going back to avoiding supplements and getting back to plants and vegetables, avoiding things that come in a jar or a can. Get that, go back to the natural.
Absolutely.
Carol, thanks so much. You've taught the other doctors on the panel something new, which is great. So we really appreciate you calling in.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So we have a few minutes left, and I think it just to kind of summarize a little what we've been hearing is it really goes back to just diet, lifestyle, what you put in your mouth and what you chew and swallow and natural and close to the way nature intended it seems to be the one of the best things you can do for your gastrointestinal tract, it sounds like.
We are what we eat.
Yeah. So there was a question that was sent in regarding the gallbladder epidemic, as the caller described it, where it seemed that there was more and more people having their gallbladders out, even young people. Some people attribute this to perhaps a high-fat diet. Is this something that's been going on, Al? Is there a trend towards gallbladder disease?
I don't know that I've seen any data showing an increase in the rates of cholecystectomies, which is the surgery where we remove the gallbladder. Dr. Warner may be able to comment on it. But we do see a situation where people may or may not have gallstones, and oftentimes people have gallstones that don't cause problems, but they still have pain. And if the pain is typical in some for gallbladder problems, and if some other specialized imaging studies are done that suggest the gallbladder is not contracting properly to a stimulus, which in the case of a normal healthy person, our gallbladder contracts after we eat a meal to empty bile into the small intestines. But if test shows that the gallbladder is not contracting properly, then sometimes that's a reason for us to send the patient to the surgeon to get their gallbladder out, and that's a condition called biliary dyskinesia.
I would say that there's probably a big increase in gallbladders coming out, not over the past 10 years, probably going back to the past 30 years. Ever since laparoscopy was introduced and taking out a gallbladder became much easier, much better tolerated. I'll give you a little anecdote. When I was a surgery resident back in the 90s, we had a chairman emeritus who had been the chairman in the 60s, who made his living doing peptic ulcer disease surgery when he started, sort of a surgery that's not really done that much anymore. Through his career into the 80s, everything changed. He no longer did peptic ulcer disease surgery. He made his living by doing gallbladder surgery, the lap chole, which is a fairly straightforward, fairly easy to do surgery. It doesn't take that long. Recuperation is very quick. Some people go home the same day. So it's an easy-to-do operation. However, there are certain ramifications for taking out a gallbladder. It is a useful organ. It helps us in our digestion of fats. And people who eat too much fat, well, that has complications. I see the end result, the hemorrhoids that they get from not having fat metabolism, the diarrhea that they get. So there are complications from taking out gallbladders too much. That being said, there are certainly people who need their gallbladder taken out. I saw a patient today who had nausea for months and months. Gallbladder taken out, doing great, never had a problem. So it is a useful tool in our armamentarium, possibly getting overused.
I would agree.
Well, you know, we have some other callers who've been waiting patiently, and unfortunately we are out of time this evening. But this has been a very interesting conversation, and we just barely scratched the surface this evening. And I do want to thank my guests this evening, Dr. Andrew Werner, colorectal surgeon, Dr. John Bienvenu, gastroenterologist, and nutritionist Julie Hartley for their time and their expertise. I know our listeners appreciate all that you were able to offer this evening, and all that you do for your patients. I want to remind our listeners that Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult your physician or healthcare provider. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, its staff, or LSUS. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. The Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Phone assistance has been provided this evening by Sheila Lawrence and Tim Snell. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters, Mental Health Edition. Our topic will be stalking, as January is Stalking Awareness Month. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Thank you for joining us this evening.